I'm Gin Dumchus, and this is The Codcast, Commonwealth Beacon's podcast about policy and civic life here in Massachusetts. Today, we're playing a panel that I recently moderated in Quincy at the Quincy Public Library about the MBTA Communities Act. It's a controversial law pinning state officials versus local officials, and really at the heart of it, it's a fight over local control and zoning for multifamily housing. I chose Quincy as the first of what we hope to be multiple panels like this because Quincy's always been ahead of the curve. There was a large fight over 60 years ago about even bringing the MBTA's red line to the city. And before the MBTA Communities Law was passed, Quincy was already undergoing a housing boom, building apartment towers and new housing as its own population boomed to about 101,000 people. So with me that night at the Quincy Public Library were three folks. The first, Andrea Harris-Long from the Metropolitan Area Planning Council. She's been there since 2021, and before that, she worked at planning organizations in the Seattle area and in South Carolina. The next guest was Rep. Russell Holmes. He was first elected in 2010, and he represents Dorchester, Mattapan, Hyde Park, and a few other Boston neighborhoods, and he works as a certified financial planner. And then the last guest is Quincy City Council President Ian Kane. He's been the Ward 3 City Councilor since 2016, and this past January, he was elected president by his colleagues. We're going to start with Andrea, who will set the scene for us about exactly what the MBTA Communities Act does.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight and joining us. So as Gin mentioned, I'm a planner by trade, so I really love talking about planning things, and I'll try not to get too excited about all the topics tonight. But as you all know, the greater Boston area, we have a housing crisis. Housing is unaffordable. People are leaving because they can't afford to stay here. The people who are able to stay here maybe are paying way too much and can't do other things that they need to do to live a quality of life that they want. And so the legislature, you know, recognized that and passed this law in 2021, in the MBTA Communities Law. And what it says is the 177 communities that are served by the MBTA, they have to do some work on their zoning. And we know that in certain places, not all different housing types are allowed. Zoning can be kind of restrictive. Some places only allow single family homes or maybe different scales of multifamily, but not really a good range of housing types. And so what this state law does is says, all of these 177 communities need to adopt a new zoning district or make some revisions to their existing zoning to allow for multifamily. And it has some kind of wonky guidelines to go with it. There has to be a minimum density of 15 units per acre, which can actually be accomplished in like 2 to 3 story buildings. So I think that that's one of the misconceptions, is that this is kind of only for those high-rise multifamily developments, but actually multifamily is defined as anything 3 units or more. So it's really up to a community to really craft what that zoning looks like. The other interesting thing that planners really like about this law is that there are deadlines attached to it. I know that's tough for cities and towns because it required a lot of quick action to really dig into zoning, but the state law says by 2022, the rapid transit communities, which are those along the subway lines, needed to enact their zoning and be in compliance. And then in 2024, this year, all of the commuter rail communities have to do some zoning work. And then by 2025, the adjacent small towns, those kind of on the fringes that don't necessarily have subway or commuter rail stops, but they still are in the service area, they have to do work on their zoning. So it means that over the next 3 years, we can actually start to address this housing crisis by unlocking one barrier to housing production, which is zoning. Zoning doesn't build houses. It's not a production mandate. So this is really just focusing on the land use regulations and making sure that cities and towns are loosening up their zoning a bit more to allow for just different housing types. So that's kind of a high-level overview. I'm sure we'll get more into the weeds of it, but hopefully that's helpful.
And Rep. Holmes, you're a member of the legislature, and when the legislature voted on MBTA Communities Law, it was actually part of a larger bill, and that's been used as kind of a sometimes saying like, oh, well, you know, it was actually kind of like shuttled in and as part of something else. Can you tell us a little bit about the atmosphere of when that passed, and did lawmakers know what they were voting on?
Sure. So I find it interesting that many people say often that we pile all these things into our economic development bills and none of us know what's going on. What I can tell you is that each one of us get to the building and we have our own priorities. So some of us could be fighting for mass growth capital money, and I'm going to make sure the time the economic development bill comes out is that there. or someone might be looking for this change. And we all understand that for these bills to pass, there's a little give and take. And I was actually informed that this was going to happen, and it was like other members of the Black Latino Caucus were like, this is a cool thing to do. Many of us inside of the cities, because the Black Latino Caucus is mainly Lawrence, Springfield, Boston, Holyoke cities, we feel like we have been the folks who have been carrying much of the burden for housing and for all of our regions, in particular, much of the burden for affordable housing. So when you say, what's the climate, we didn't think it went far enough, many of us. We're like, okay, we're going to put these zones in, but what about, you can go and you can build these multifamilies, but they could, a lot of it could just be market. We were looking for trying to make sure that we can also build affordable units in these multiple families, multifamilies as well. So the climate was, we in Massachusetts, of course, want to be the best in the world and the best in the country, and we are going to continue to do everything we can to spur economic development. So this was just one of those things. Housing is just part of the economic development that came with all of the other things that were inside the bill. So I know that's the tone that we don't know what we're doing. We get in the middle of the night, none of us know what we're voting on. I'm just going to say right now that's a lie. Sure, there are many things in these outside sections that we get a summary of and hear about, but then our challenges or our priorities become the things that are priority to us. And there are, you know, 200 members, and each one of those members have things that we know are important. And in the end, the goal is to try to get these things across the finish line, and we did. My only other comment was about climate, was that when the MMA sent their letter, which was a pretty strong letter, to say, hey, Charlie, you shouldn't sign this, you should veto this, I was actually surprised that he didn't veto it because of the fact that I think many of the things they put in their letter to the governor have become true, right? So it's all about whether or not this could be local control, whether or not we were trying to exact some type of hard hammer. And the answer was yes, we were. And I will end by just saying again, this is easy to me compared to what I said to you earlier today. I think of the folks who were in the Mass legislature and more than 100 years ago who said, we're going to go out and we're going to create the Quabbin Reservoir and flood four towns and move four towns and make sure that we had enough water for the Boston metro area. That was a hard decision. And that was one that we made a decision, or they made a decision about what they thought was best for the Commonwealth. And so did we. And so we need more housing. This is not enough. I would have gone farther with affordable housing. And that's kind of the climate that I can say was happening amongst me and other members of the Black Latino Caucus.
Say MMA, you mean Mass Municipal Association?
Of course. Yeah. Yep, sorry.
So, no, I just wanted to. So one more question before I turn to President Kane. What's the feedback you're getting from colleagues and people you know you run into now? I know state reps are some of the most accessible folks. You know,
they try to be.
And so what are you hearing from both fellow members across the region and both here and then from voters? What do they say?
I hear more from you guys in the press than I do from my colleagues. Right. So we made a decision. I think. We have made a decision that we think this is what's best for the Commonwealth. There are obviously some folks who are unhappy. You've seen some of my colleagues who have put in bills to try to change it, and we, of course, are still tweaking it. You've mentioned Milton more than once. Clearly, some of the colleagues in Milton, part of that problem is they felt like it shouldn't be a rapid transit neighborhood. It should have been deemed something else. But as a person who grew up across the water from Milton, I've always felt like I was attached to the red line, just like I said to Ian. I mean, you get on the trolley, you go to the Ashmont, and you go down the red line, but all of that feels like all one line. So they were trying to find a little carve-out to say that they shouldn't do it. But I'm thankful that the Attorney General lives actually closer to Central Ave. She goes down her street, take a left, take a right. She's in Milton. So I'm happy she understands this debate and argument very well, and I'm happy she did the right thing by saying, we expect all of our towns and cities to do exactly what we ask, and some of them may not be happy with that, but we're trying our best to solve a problem that is one that if we don't solve, we'll continue to have many, many, many of these young folks leaving this Commonwealth.
President Kane, I want to talk about Quincy. You've been on the City Council for a decade, almost a decade, and so you've seen kind of the development boom that was happening even before the MBT Communities Law came into play. So, you know, what's been happening in Quincy, and then looking ahead, what's going to happen now that there is this MBTA law?
So it's interesting trying to hear the juxtaposition between the cities and towns that have not been so favorable and welcoming to this Communities Act, because Quincy went through its own planning process of its own. We sought growth. So, you know, we were going through planning urban renewal districts, which we've done in the downtown area. We just planned an urban renewal district around Wollaston T Station. When I first joined the council, when I was first elected in 2015, we went through a series of discussions around planning transit-oriented districts around three of our T stations out of the four. And at that time, I had a problem with, we were going to overlay each of the three other MBTA districts outside of Quincy Center with the same zoning overlay. And the problem that I had was that all three of those T stations represent very different characteristic neighborhoods. And so, you know, looking at a sort of more macro implementation of a Communities Act that looks at 177, I would probably take the same perspective, which is there's not a one size fits all. I understand the needs and the demands and the supply constraints, which Quincy has been, you know, very well absorbing. But there are cities and towns that certainly want that type of growth, and there are cities and towns that absolutely do not. And personally, I think that's within their rights to have a problem with, to seek amendments or resolutions to. When we did have to fall into compliance with the Communities Act, similarly, if we're trying to design an improvement of housing around transit-oriented districts, the biggest problem that we have is that our transit is broken. So I don't know why we're trying to put thousands more units in places around T stations that don't operate efficiently and are unpredictable. So, you know, to me, there was sort of a chicken and egg problem of, well, why don't we fix the transit system before we start putting housing around the places that you'd like to co-locate people in transit that don't currently mix and work together?
Okay, so I can't even tweet that out at your mouth. Sorry.
Yeah.
We have hired who we think is the role now is not one that is more political, which is what it had been for a long, long time. We went and got a transit expert, and we need to get the people off the roads. You know, this chicken or egg. No, I need to have a great transit system. We didn't just go and pass $1 billion for transit and education for us to believe that we're not going to have good transit. To develop and build these buildings is going to take years. You might, you know, change the zone, but by the time that building is built, it's 5-10 years from now. My transit will be better. And so we're going to continue to demand that Ng and his whole team makes transit better. Like the decision for me to do it also with an equitable lens, that now I can get on the Mattapan Square on the trolley and I don't get a slow zone until I get to JFK. And to have it so that we're going to eliminate all slow zones by the end of this year is the first good step. And so we have faith that we have the resources and really the dedication to make sure we get our transit better. And housing is years away, and I want folks off these single-use cars coming right through Mattapan Square. Like I stand in the middle at down at the end of my street, and I see all these folks coming through my neighborhood in one person in the vehicle. Because I say, go get on 93. Why are you riding right up Blue Avenue? Go get off my road.
You're essentially supporting my point. Right?
I'm just saying, go get on the train. Don't be getting
in
the car.
But it's not that simple. So things have changed since COVID.
Yeah,
right?
people have decided they like being in the car by themselves. That's what they've decided.
Or they've decided that time is more valuable to them, and they...
I disagree.
Well, I'm watching it. From my perspective, we've got issues here in the state where people don't have reliable transit. They don't have to go to work as often as they do, so they can pick and choose their schedules if they are so fortunate to do that. And so they're getting in cars, they're driving into town, they're even getting into Ubers, which are faster than using public transit.
Which is making it worse.
Correct, which is making it worse. So, again, the problem is the transit doesn't work, and that's not a problem of this new general manager of the T. This is an existing problem. This is a decades-old problem. But to come in and say, we need to dramatically increase by tens of thousands of units by transit-oriented districts that currently don't serve its ultimate use with transit, is just a tough thing to swallow.
Yeah. So this is a debate we're going to have between local and state. Our job is to try our best to make it so that we make statewide decisions for 177 people. I see this debate happening at the federal level. Obviously, Texas think they should leave and say that the feds aren't doing the job they need to do, so they're going to go out and try to do it. We see it happening in my city, too. Like, I have 77 units trying to build at Seven Hill, at a train station, And folks are saying, why are you building it? And literally all you do is walk out the train station and walk out of your home and go down to the train station and say, oh, well, you know, the train doesn't run. No, that's, I don't think it's just the train's not running. I think COVID has changed, like you said, people's approach and ideas around work and the like. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also made people very selfish. People got into these corners. They think about themselves only. They don't think about, there are rich people who ride transit in New York, rich. Don't matter how poor you are, and their transit is not much better than ours, but it's just a culture that, I know, sorry. You got two politicians going at it. You shouldn't have let us get into this. All right, I'll stop, but I appreciate
the passion for sure, but the ultimate that we agree on is that there's a bigger problem here, and it's systemic. And yes, people might be selfish, but there's no legislation that can enforce a person being selfish and not use a car at this point in time.
So here's what I had to make a decision. Yeah. I have to make a decision that says I have to choose, and I make the choice because most people are trying to figure out their car and where the car is going to park and how many people they're going to have. The person already has the car, I have to make a choice. Am I going to choose to create a place for someone to live or to make sure I protect someone's parking spot for someone who already has a place to live? And that's what this is becoming. I choose to give someone a place to live over someone who already has a place to live to have a parking spot. And that's the decision I'm making as we continue to build all over this Commonwealth and all over this city and all over the state. I need to say we need to have a lot more housing. And it can't be that you say, hey, our transit isn't good, and so I'm not going to build any housing. I hear you loud and clear.
No, that was not what I said. There's a difference. I said there's a chicken and egg. And I said, one, the problem originally is the transit, right? And then we're increasing stock around transit, and it does not work. So if you've got 12,000 more units that we're supposed to absorb in Quincy Adams T station in a particular area, right? What does that do to that neighborhood? People are going to come with cars anyway. The T still doesn't work. You know, how are you absorbing that capacity over time?
And so I hear also people say, well, what about our schools? Well, I'm saying we don't say that about Boston. When Boston absorbs all of the students that come, it's almost like when you read The Color of Law, it is clear that these things are intentional. It isn't. So from my perspective, we have had 100 years, decades of law that have made it so these communities, many of them, don't want more housing. It is intentional. They wanted these, create these laws that make it so that you have a very large lot, at least 1 acre and all the other stuff to keep other people out. I believe it's intentional. And it was through law. And so we're coming back with law to try to change that. And that's basically how I see it.
So I did want to touch on kind of the shift, you know, what people are seeing both with this and with what Mayor Wu is trying to do in Boston with the change in zoning is it's very much a change in local control. It's a change of what people are used to, right? That people are used to showing up at a meeting, complaining about a development, and the developer then coming back and saying, okay, well, I'll do like 80 units instead of 90 or whatever, and then so on and so forth. So, Andrea, I wanted to ask, what kind of trends are you seeing in terms of this shift in how people are talking about zoning and development?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that zoning amendments happen all the time without a state law being required. A lot of the communities that we work with, we have 101 cities and towns in our region, and what we usually do before the state law kind of changed the game and had us focusing more on implementing 3A is we would help communities do downtown zoning updates or mixed-use districts because they had a business corridor, but they knew that the zoning wasn't really supporting that business corridor to grow. And so zoning amendments happen all the time. And I think your question about local control is really interesting because to me, that's where you can shift and actually have the local control be in crafting your zoning, not on an individual development basis. Because ideally, if you have good zoning, you don't need to have that really long development review process. You can have your zoning really be shaping what kind of development you want to see in your community. I think it's important to note that the state law does require flexibility. The requirement is for by right, but that doesn't mean that you can't require site plan review, which can really help shape what a site looks like and how buildings interact with the neighborhood around it. You can have design guidelines, you can have height requirements, you can have setback requirements, all of those things that you naturally think about whenever you're writing zoning and amending zoning over time, you can still do. So the state I think, did a smart thing. And by saying you have to have a minimum density of 15 units per acre, some communities say that's great. Others are going to want to have 30 units per acre or 40 units per acre. It's up to them. You can also, you know, have one district centered around your train station if you, you know, are doing a transit-oriented approach. I think that you all have already been doing the things that 3A is trying to accomplish here in Quincy. But you can also spread it out. So maybe you have a commuter rail station. You can do half of your district around that. But you also have a neighborhood that you want to have more investment and growth there, and you're going to put the rest of your new zoning in that area, or you'll tweak some of the zoning that you already have. So I think that there's still local control, but helping to think about where that local control should actually be best used. And if you're doing zoning amendments and zoning work and tweaks in the best way, you're involving the community in that process so that you don't have to get bogged down and having planning board and like individual discretionary review processes be where that engagement is happening. Because I think that if you do that step back, you can actually have more equitable engagement and involve people more. I think if you think about who is engaging in planning board meetings on that site-specific development review process, it's probably not actually that much local control other than a handful of people who go to those meetings and have control.
President Kane, you've been at those meetings, right? And you hear from constituents when they're unhappy with a development. What's your take on this? You know, in some people's view, it's a loss of local control.
I will just continue probably the same narrative that I started from the beginning. It is. I appreciate the work of your organization and the work of the legislature. I'm not a full adherent to central planning, right? You know, Quincy has its very own unique identity. It wants to maintain and protect or have more control over its own destiny.
That's right. It's potential.
Well, again, you're coming from a different place, and I understand the place that you're coming from and the message that you're trying to send.
I'm trying to send a message. You're sending a message. It's protection.
Well, every time I speak, you keep speaking over me, so you're trying to send a message.
No,
so,
I'm hearing you, and it's about local control, and I'm saying...
And we don't have to agree.
You're local. I got it.
Yeah. Well, this is my job, right?
But protect. Yeah. That's the word you use, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, to protect the integrity of the municipality. Correct. Yeah, that's our role, right? You have a different job. You're doing what you need to do as a city councilor. In ward matters, I represent a district of Quincy. Most of that district is residential A, maybe residential B. People want to maintain those neighborhoods. Those are the only neighborhoods that are left like it, right? People want to live in single-family homes. The cost of living right now for people, labor markets aren't keeping up with cost of living right now, right? People want to buy into this concept of an American dream still, and it's different from, you know, living in an apartment complex somewhere. So people that live in these, and there's no transitional housing either available. So from young people to older people, there's nowhere to go. So I get the need to, you know, fix our housing issues, to put concepts in different places, but at the end of the day, I'm still doing my job.
All right, can I speak?
Yeah, yes.
I'm not going to cut you again. I didn't mean to be rude. That's not what I was trying to do. A couple things. In the city of Boston, we have thousands of zoning meetings and thousands of these folks trying to tell people what to do in their houses. And so my understanding is in New York, because many things are as of right, they have maybe 20, I think, is the number, some ridiculous low number for having to go to do a zoning board because of the fact that they've essentially planned out the city and people go and build as of right. And so when you ask the question again about what the mayor is doing, are we going to go from thousands to 20? No, we might go from thousands to a couple hundred. But much of the cost of building in this commonwealth, in this region, is because I'm going through 15 of these community meetings, right? And so you have to have the lawyer there, you have to have the architect there, you have to have the person who's building, and all of that stuff just adds more and more cost to building the unit.
So on the subject of tweaking, I want to talk about the state regs for a little bit, because there's the law, and then there's what the Housing and Economic Development, Housing and Livable Communities Secretariat put forward. Andrea, can you talk a little bit about the regs, and then Rep. Holmes and President Kane, maybe you could talk about what would you change if you had the power of Ed Augustus?
Yeah, so the guidelines are somewhat specific in that you have to have a minimum land area, 50 acres in size. I already mentioned the density requirement, 15 units per acre is a minimum. There are some other regulations around what your zoned unit capacity is. That was kind of done in a way to look at how many housing units you have today and then have it be proportional so that it's not, if you have 10,000 units today, you have to have 10,000 of zoned unit capacity. They tried to make it reasonable in that way. So you can actually go online and kind of look at every community and what those requirements are. And then it had some other specific things that very in the weeds about like how much of the land area needs to be by your transit station area or your commuter rail stop. If you don't have either of those things, then you do have flexibility to put it wherever it makes sense in your community. I think it's really important to note that most of the communities in the 177 area have been doing planning work. They have long-range plans, like a comprehensive plan or a master plan, or they've done neighborhood planning. So ideally, those are informing how they're working on their zoning, because the guidelines do allow you to do different customization of the zoning. So the guidelines set that stage, but then there is a lot of flexibility for communities to impact how those guidelines play out locally.
So, President Kane, if you had the regulatory power of Secretary Augustus, what would you tweak or what would you change about the regs that are out there right now?
That's an interesting question. I, you know, don't have a magic wand. I don't have those regulatory powers. And I just keep coming back to kind of, it seems like from what was a political process, right? And when it happened, I mean, this happened in the Baker administration, right? And now Governor Healey's had to deal with sort of the outfall of this bill. So, I always think that especially when it comes to local issues like housing, which everything becomes local at the end of the day, but just more public engagement, right? There should have been more public engagement to enfranchise people that they were a participatory part of the growth of their city or town, right? And then it wouldn't be such a fear-based discussion about we're dropping in all this and we're going to, it's a hammer and it's a mandate from on high, you know? That doesn't play. If you want to welcome progress and change, I think it needs to be, if you said it's going to take a long time, then why don't we roll it out a little slower so that it's palatable instead of this fight? Because now in places like Quincy, where we're doing our job, we're absorbing the capacity, we've been doing it anyway without the need for a mandate, we should be rewarded for the things that we're doing as opposed to Milton being punished for, what they're not. And I think that's a better way to look at it.
Rep. Holmes.
Speaker of the House is from Quincy, so it's not surprising to me that this was something that obviously you guys were doing already. I'm going to just say it this way. Right now we're debating the gun bill. One that here in this legislature that we didn't want to change our gun laws. We believe that we are the safest state in the country from a gun death perspective for a reason. And that is because we have some of the most strict gun laws there are. However, when the Supreme Court says to us, 6-3, or the court that we're not agreeable to, they say, hey, you have to change it because your gun laws are too strict. Guess what we have to do? We have to change them. That is, as you say, on high. That is the feds telling the state what we need to do. The state is going to then say to the cities what we think you need to do. And that is just the government we live in. This is called a democracy.
I wanted to also touch on climate change. And should the state take into account how climate change is going to impact not all MBTA communities, but some of them over the next 30 years? A subset will be facing shrinking geographic footprints. I don't think Howes Neck is going to be around in 40 or 50 years. So should the state be taking climate change into account? Andrea, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I think that the state is. I think that the state's doing a lot of really good work on climate resiliency, climate adaptation. I think kind of building on the last question into this, I think that it's important that all communities are doing their fair share for housing. That's the importance of this law, right? That we all need to be doing something to advance our housing goals. And some communities can do that differently. I think that coastal communities will have to be a little bit more creative in how they're addressing their housing needs. I think that as we were talking, shorelines are shrinking, land is, going away, being ceded back to the ocean. That just means that we have to be smarter with how we use that land. And that's where zoning really is intended to help you be smart about how you're growing, being smart about how you're using the precious resource that you do have. And multifamily, multi-unit developments are more efficient. You get, you know, more buildings if you can have a couple stories rather than having a single-family home on an acre lot. That's not a very efficient use of land. So I think that it is more challenging, and I think that new development does offer climate benefits because newer buildings are going to be more energy efficient. You have an opportunity to raise them if you know you're in a flood area. You also have an opportunity to actually help with flooding because stormwater can be better managed with new developments. So there are trade-offs, but it does take more work and more planning on the environmental side to complement the housing work.
I can't say it any better than Andrea, but I think it's we're fortunate that Housneck is not a transit-oriented district. Yeah.
Rev Holmes?
So, yes. I think about some of the things we've done in Boston. We just built thousands and thousands of units in the seaport, and we're going to run into a problem that they're going to come in and ask us to put up a barrier wall. Like, so, yeah. And at some point, you're going to have all these rich people who built all these houses and places that they probably shouldn't have. You see already the aquariums flooding. What do you think is about to happen in some of the most other expensive places? And they're going to ask us for is a barrier wall. Come out here and spend $100 million to protect our, you know, our home. So that's a great question, though, again, because of the fact that some of the law talks about how many acreages and things should be used. And so that, again, is one of the other tweaks that we need to make sure that we should do.
Thank you for listening. I'm Gin Dumchus. Our producer is John Gee. We'd love for you to leave a rating or a review wherever you're hearing this now. And email us at codcast@commonwealthbeacon.org if you ever want to get in touch directly. We'll be back with you next week.